Last week, we finished the first two chapters of Samuel, where Samuel gets born, and we find out about Hophni and Phinehas, the worthless sons of Eli. So tonight what we'll do is we will get Hophni and Phinehas polished off, and we'll get into what the Philistines do with the Ark, or the Ark does with the Philistines. I always love that section of Scripture because God's got a sense of humor. So the last thing in chapter 2 is where a prophet comes and talks to Eli and tells him that his line of priests will thereafter not have an old man in their house, and that his two sons are going to die. So that was where we quit. We're now in chapter 3. Now the young man Samuel was ministering to the Lord under Eli, and the word of the Lord was rare in those days. There was no frequent vision. We've said this lots of times before, but early in the Bible, the barrier, if you will, between the spiritual world and the physical world seemed to be far more porous than it was as we move along. Early, you have people minding their own business, and somebody walks up and starts talking to them, and all of a sudden they realize they're talking to an angel or a spiritual being. That apparently has become rare. And the next thing, if you will, instead of spirit beings speaking directly to people, we'll have prophets who will be sent by God and will be the mouthpieces of God to people. We're sort of in a transition here. Verse 2. At that time, Eli, whose eyesight had begun to grow dim so that he could not see, was lying down in his own place. The lamp of God had not yet gone out, and Samuel was lying down in the temple of the Lord where the ark of God was. I have no idea what that's all about. You all know from the Torah that only the high priest would go into the ark of God. Now, what it may be is the lamps hadn't gone out, which means that he may have been in there to tend the lamps, which would mean that he is in the holy place, but not the Holy of Holies. I otherwise don't know. I'm just guessing there. Wicks had to be trimmed, oil had to be topped off, and I suspect they had to be relit. So I am guessing that one of Samuel's jobs was tending the menorah. Verse 4, then the Lord called Samuel, and he said, "Here am I," and ran to Eli and said, "Here I am, for you called me." But he said, "I did not call. Lie down again." So he went to lay down. The Lord called again, "Samuel." And Samuel rose and went to Eli and said, "Here I am, for you called me." But he said, "I did not call, my son. Lie down again." Now Samuel did not yet know the Lord, and the word of the Lord had not yet been revealed to him. So all he's getting is a voice, and obviously he thinks it's Eli, and hops up and goes to find out what's going on. Verse 8, and the Lord called Samuel again a third time, and he arose and went to Eli and said, "Here I am, for you called me." And Eli perceived that the Lord was calling the young man. Therefore Eli said to Samuel, "Go lie down, and if he calls you, you shall say, 'Speak, Lord, for your servant hears.'" So Samuel went and lay down in his place. You sort of got to give Eli some credit. He was probably asleep, and this kid comes charging in and says, "I'm here." And he may not be too alert and awake, and so it takes him a while to figure out what's going on. Verse 10, and the Lord came and stood calling out as other times, "Samuel, Samuel." And Samuel said, "Speak, for your servant hears." Now, the Lord came and stood calling as at other times. I'm not sure what's going on there. If we were to correlate this with things like when God shows up to Abraham or angel of the Lord shows up and so forth, the messenger looks just like a man. And it is not the case that anybody figures out it isn't a man until something weird happens. So the idea that there's somebody standing there with him could be that, or it could be a figure of speech. I just don't know. So 10 again. And the Lord came and stood, calling as at other times, "Samuel, Samuel." And Samuel said, "Speak, for your servant hears." Then the Lord said to Samuel, "Behold, I am about to do a thing in Israel, at which the two ears of everyone who hears it will tingle. On that day I will fulfill against Eli all that I have spoken concerning his house from beginning to end. And I declare to him that I am about to punish his house forever for the iniquity that he knew, because his sons were blaspheming God. And of course, you all know that they were grifting out of the sacrificial offerings and so forth. God did not regard it as petty theft. God regarded it as blaspheming against him. And I declare to him that I'm about to punish his house forever for the iniquity that he knew because his sons were blaspheming God and he did not restrain them. Therefore, I swear to the house of Eli that the iniquity of Eli's house shall not be atoned for by sacrifice or offering forever. Verse 15. Samuel lay until morning. Then he opened the doors of the house of the Lord, and Samuel was afraid to tell the vision to Eli. But Eli called Samuel and said, "Samuel, my son." And he said, "Here I am." And Eli said, "What was it that he told you? Do not hide it from me. May God do so to you and more also if you hide anything from me of all that he told you." So Samuel told him everything and hid nothing from him. And he said, "It is the Lord. Let him do what seems good to him." What we've got here is two witnesses. Remember, we had a man of God show up and give that prophecy. And then, of course, it comes to Samuel. So you've got two witnesses, if you will, and Eli accepts the inevitable. The other thing that is interesting, back in verse 14, "Therefore I swear to the house of Eli that the iniquity of Eli's house shall not be atoned for by sacrifice or offering forever." And you all have been through the Torah enough that you know that there are no sacrifices for willful sin. All of the temple or tabernacle sacrifices are for unintentional sin. And in fact, there are sacrifices for, quote, defrauding, unquote, God. In other words, if you use something that was set aside for the Lord, made holy, and you use it inadvertently, you can bring a sacrifice and you can replace it. I don't remember what the ratio is, but replace basically more than what you took, and that's okay. But God is saying here, I'm not going to allow that to happen with the sons of Eli. And I suspect that's because their behavior in that sense was so flagrant and so long-standing that there's no way it could be looked on as inadvertent. The comment was that Eli pretty much knew what was coming because he'd had the prophet come to him before. So the fact that there was perhaps bad news via Samuel would not have been a surprise. And you remember in the book of Daniel, where Daniel gets the vision of the cedar tree. And he says, "Oh, Nebuchadnezzar, may this dream be for your enemies." And is reluctant to speak it, because if you speak a vision like that to somebody in power, that somebody in power may get chapped enough at you that he will take retribution. I don't know that Samuel was afraid that Eli was going to kill him, but he certainly didn't want to be the bearer of bad news and didn't want to be punished for, how shall we say it, a false prophecy if it didn't turn out to be that. Verse 19, "And Samuel grew, and the Lord was with him, and let none of his words fall to the ground. And all Israel from Dan to Beersheba knew that Samuel was established as a prophet of the Lord. And the Lord appeared again at Shiloh, for the Lord revealed himself to Samuel at Shiloh by the word of the Lord." None of his words fall to the ground. Obviously, that's a metaphor, that when Samuel speaks, whatever he says prophetically happens. And also notice the passage of time here. As we're looking at chapter 4, where the Philistines are going to capture the ark, it isn't at all clear what the time interval is between the prophecies that come to Eli and the actual fulfillment of them. Chapter 4. "And the word of Samuel came to all Israel. Now Israel went out to battle against the Philistines. They encamped at Ebenezer, and the Philistines encamped at Aphek." All right, I've got a map up here behind me. And for those of you out in internet land, you can pull up a map of central Israel, topo map. Just look for the Battle of Aphek, and you can see what's going on. And what I want you to notice is the terrain. The terrain to the west of Aphek is flat. to the east, starting at Ebenezer, it's starting to get mountainous. The Philistines have chariots. So the Philistines would like to fight out in the flat where their chariots get room to roll and maneuver. The Israelites don't have chariots. So the Israelites would like to fight in the rough terrain where the chariots can't maneuver. Aphek is a perfect place for Israel because first off, it's right up against the hills to the east, which means if things go badly, they can retreat into the hills and the chariots can't follow them. But the other thing I want you to notice here is the streams and the road. You see, you've got a stream, the Yarkon River, that runs from Aphek out to the Mediterranean. And then you've got a river to the north, and what this area is sort of marshy. So the chariots are canalized so that they don't have a lot of room to maneuver, and they have to stay pretty much on the road. So from Israel's point of view, if you're going to mess with the Philistines, that's probably the best place to do it, because the Philistines can't use their chariots to best advantage there. In fact, on a personal note, I think I've all told you how I came to belief. I was in the Episcopal Church and we had what they call a supply priest. Our priest was off on sabbatical and they had a guy in there for the summer and he was writing a book on the battles of Israel. And he had these big topo maps. And he laid out this battle here and explained what the terrain was. And I looked at it and said, yeah, I'm a military engineer. If I was fighting this, that's where I'd do it. And I said, well, if that makes sense, what else makes sense? And I started taking the Bible seriously. And as they say, the rest is history. But this is as favorable a place as there is for Israel to attack against the Philistines. Their chariots are less effective there than they would be out someplace like Lod or someplace where they got a lot of flat area for them to roll. So, 4-1. Now, Israel went out to battle against the Philistines. They encamped at Ebenezer, and the Philistines encamped at Aphek. The Philistines drew up in line against Israel, and when the battle spread, Israel was defeated by the Philistines, who killed about 4,000 men on the field of battle. Obviously, this first battle went very badly for the Israelites, and what they can do then is they can withdraw back into the hills, and they have a way of retreat. One of the things that is an axiom in military tactics and strategy is, first off, don't tug on Superman's cape, but the other is you want to make sure that you have a route of escape. So if you go into a battle and things are going badly, you'd like to be able to withdraw to somebody safe, regroup, and perhaps try again tomorrow. The other thing that you don't ever want to do is you don't want to engage in what we call a decisive battle unless you're sure you're going to win it, because you get wiped out. And again, that's not what you want, obviously. So the fact that they lost 4,000 men is not good, obviously, but they survived and are going to take another run at them. So verse 3, and when the troops came to the camp, the elders of Israel said, why has the Lord defeated us today before the Philistines? Let us bring the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord here from Shiloh, that it may come among us and save us from the power of our enemies. First off, the question, why has the Lord defeated us today? They were not expecting to lose this. They had picked a place where they thought they had a good chance of winning, and so getting beaten was a surprise. And of course, they ascribed their defeat correctly to the Lord and decide to bring the covenant of the Lord here. Verse 4. So the people sent to Shiloh and brought from there the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord of hosts, who was enthroned on the cherubim. And the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were there with the Ark of the Covenant of God. These guys are the two officiating priests, if you will. So when the Ark moves out, they go with it. Verse 5. As soon as the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord came into the camp, all Israel gave a mighty shout, so that the earth resounded. And when the Philistines heard the noise of the shouting, they said, what does this great shouting in the camp of the Hebrews mean? And when they learned that the Ark of the Lord had come into the camp, the Philistines were afraid. For they said, a god has come into the camp. And they said, woe is us, for nothing like this has happened before. The Philistines are pagans, polytheists, and so they don't recognize that this is the God. They recognize that it is a God. And as we'll see in a minute, they recognize that it is a very powerful God. So they are under no illusions that this is just some random idol. Verse 8 now. Woe to us! Who can deliver us from the power of these mighty gods? These are the gods who struck the Egyptians with every sort of plague in the wilderness. So they know the history, they know what Jehovah has done, and they're afraid. Verse 9, take courage and be men, O Philistines, lest you become slaves to the Hebrews as they have been to you. Be men and fight. So obviously one of the causes of this conflict is the Philistines have been enslaving the Hebrews, and the Hebrews are trying to get out from under it. And so they're pumping up their courage. Verse 10, so the Philistines fought, and Israel was defeated, and they fled, every man to his home. And there was a very great slaughter, for there fell of Israel 30,000 foot soldiers, and the ark of God was captured. And the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, died. You can see the relative proportion. You got 30,000 casualties in the second battle and only 4,000 in the first. So by withdrawing from the first battle, the majority of the Israelite force had been preserved. And of course, we have the fulfillment of the prophecy given to both the man of God and to Samuel. Verse 12. A man of Benjamin ran from the battle line and came to Shiloh the same day, with his clothes torn and with dirt on his head. When he arrived, Eli was sitting on his seat by the road watching, for his heart trembled for the ark of God. And when the man came into the city and told the news, all the city cried out. Pause here for a minute. You remember I said Kay and I had watched this course by Justin Jackson at Hillsdale College? He makes a note here that Eli is worried about the ark. It doesn't say that Eli is worried about his two sons. And the conclusion that Jackson drew about that is one of the signs of Eli's failure as a father is he is more involved in his work than he is with his family. So his sons apparently didn't get the proper supervision when they were being brought up, which led to their becoming reprobates and is a function of his failure as a father. The comment was Eli must have approved of taking the ark. His two sons were stewards, and it would have taken more than just the two of them to carry the ark. That's correct. The ark was typically carried on the shoulders of the Levites and not on the shoulders of priests. So the fact that the priests went with the ark would have been normal, but there would have been a squad of Levites, if you will, to do the actual carrying. As far as Eli approving, I don't know, because his sons at this point are pretty much running wild on their own. He may have approved, or they may have just done it, just like they did with sacrifices and all that. In any way to know. 14. When Eli heard the sound of the outcry, he said, what is this uproar? Then the man hurried and came and told Eli. Now Eli was 98 years old, and his eyes were set so that he could not see. And the man said to Eli, I am he who came from the battle. I fled from the battle today. And he said, how did it go, my son? He who brought the news answered and said, Israel has fled before the Philistines. There has also been a great defeat among the people. Your two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, are dead, and the Ark of God has been captured. As soon as he mentioned the Ark of God, Eli fell over backward from his seat by the side of the gate. His neck was broken and he died, for the man was old and heavy. He had judged Israel 40 years. So he's old and fragile as well as being fat. And so that when he falls over, the weight of his body snaps his neck. But notice that the thing that causes him to keel over is the news about the ark. And the other thing about that, you can sort of infer, is the death of his sons was not unexpected. Because he's had the man of God prophesy it, and he's had Samuel prophesy it. So I'm sure he was saddened over the death of his sons, but from his point of view, the real tragedy was the loss of the ark. Comment was that when they lost the 4,000, their idea was, well, we lost because God wasn't in the camp. So let's bring God into the camp, and we'll beat him next time. And of course, they don't. A couple of things. Thing one, of course, is that in the past, the ark has prevailed because they had the ark go before them in the wilderness and they prevailed against their enemies. So the idea of having the ark in the camp is something they have historical precedent for. The other thing, of course, is that God is not a patsy. God does not respond to magic. So the idea that they are bringing the ark in to give them victory when God is not pleased with them, they are trying to work magic on God and get God to do something that they want to have done, regardless of whether God wants to have it done or not. That's magic. And of course, God doesn't play. As in Jeremiah, where the people say, we got the temple of the Lord, surely the city is going to be safe because God won't let anything happen to his house. And God said, no, that's not the way it's going to work. Now, what we don't have in this story, which we do have, for example, in Jeremiah, is we don't have any narrative about what the spiritual state of Israel was. Just no information. What we do have is that the priests in the temple or the tabernacle had become corrupt. And if the priesthood is corrupt, we see from other prophets, specifically Malachi and so forth, that when the shepherds go astray, the people follow. In Malachi, it says that you've got your priests and your nobles have become corrupt. Therefore, all the common people have also become corrupt. So we can infer from later prophets that if the priests had become corrupt, then the spiritual state of the nation was probably pretty sad. So, verse 19. Now his daughter-in-law, the wife of Phinehas, was pregnant, about to give birth. And when she heard the news that the ark of God was captured, and her father-in-law and her husband were dead, she bowed and gave birth, for her pains came upon her. And I suspect probably she was premature somewhat. And about the time of her death, the women attending her said to her, do not be afraid, for you have born a son. But she did not answer or pay attention. In other words, she dies in childbirth. Now, one of the things that happened in the Torah, when Rachel gave birth to Benjamin, the midwife says, don't worry, it's a boy. And that's sort of an indication that it's a breech birth. I don't know if that's the case here, but you have the same expression. And then she dies, as Rachel also died. So I sort of infer that she had a breech. And I also sort of infer that the shock of all of this, she's lost her livelihood. Because her father-in-law is dead, her husband is dead, the ark is gone, which is what he used to make a living with. And she's a widow and about to be very poor. So the shock of all of that may have brought on premature labor before the child had had a chance to turn. That's a guess. I don't know if it's true or not. 21. And she named the child Ichabod, saying, the glory has departed from Israel, because the ark of God had been captured, and because of her father-in-law and her husband. And she said, the glory has departed from Israel, for the ark of God has been captured. Chapter 5. When the Philistines captured the ark of God, they brought it from Ebenezer to Ashdod. Then the Philistines took the ark of God and brought it into the house of Dagon and set it up beside Dagon. You all know ancient history and customs. When two nations went to war back there, it was sort of assumed our gods are in this. And if we win, our gods are stronger than your God, and so forth. So capturing the God of the enemy here, you bring it into the temple of your God as a prize of war because your God has prevailed over their God. That's sort of the attitude. Verse 3, and when the people of Ashdod arose early in the next day, behold, Dagon had fallen face downward on the ground before the ark of the Lord. So they took Dagon and put him back in his place. But when they rose early on the next morning, behold, Dagon had fallen face downward on the ground before the ark of the Lord, and the head of Dagon and both his hands were lying cut off on the threshold. Only the trunk of Dagon was left to him. This is why the priests of Dagon and all who enter the house of Dagon do not tread on the threshold of Dagon in Ashdod to this day. Yes, this is a god. Yes, this is a powerful god, but he's just one of many gods. And our local god is Dagon, and we're going to keep trying this. Verse 6. The hand of the Lord was heavy against the people of Ashdod, and he terrified it and afflicted them with tumors, both Ashdod and its territory. And the word there for tumors is also hemorrhoids. That's why I say it. God has a sense of humor here. Verse 7. And when the men of Ashdod saw how things were, they said, the ark of God of Israel must not remain with us, for his hand is hard against us and against Dagon our God. For those out there in internet land, the Septuagint talks about the fact that in addition to tumors, they got plagued with mice. And we'll see in chapter 6 that one of the things they do is they send golden models of their tumors and golden mice when they return the ark. So I would go with the Septuagint on this one. Chapter 5, verse 8. So they sent and gathered together all the lords of the Philistines and said, what shall we do with the ark of the God of the Hebrews? They answered, let the ark of the God of Israel be brought around to Gath. So they brought the ark of the God of Israel there. But after they had brought it around, the hand of the Lord was against the city, causing very great panic. And he afflicted the men of the city, both old and young, so that tumors broke out on them. So they sent the ark of God to Ekron. But as soon as the ark of God came to Ekron, the people of Ekron cried out, they have brought around to us the ark of the God of Israel to kill us and our people. They sent therefore and gathered together all the lords of the Philistines and said, send away the ark of the God of Israel and let it return to its own place, that it may not kill us and our people. For there was a deathly panic throughout the whole city. The hand of God was very heavy there. The men who did not die were struck with tumors, and the cry of the city went up to heaven. One of the things that I get a kick out of because of this is Eli has fallen over dead because the ark's been captured. The ark's perfectly capable of taking care of itself. I mean, certainly he's lost his sons and he's lost the thing that he's served all his life and so forth. But he need not have worried about the fate of the ark because the ark is perfectly capable of defending himself. So, 1 Samuel 6. The ark of the Lord was in the country of the Philistines 7 months. And the Philistine called for the priests and the diviners and said, what shall we do with the ark of the Lord? Tell us, with what shall we send it to its place? They said, if you send away the ark of the God of Israel, do not send it empty, but by all means return him a guilt offering. Then you will be healed, and it will be known to you why his hand does not turn away from you. And they said, what is the guilt offering that we should return to him? They answered, 5 golden tumors and 5 golden mice, according to the number of the lords of the Philistines. For the same plague was on all of you and all your lords. So you must make images of your tumors and images of your mice that ravage the land and give glory to the God of Israel. Perhaps he will lighten his hand from off you and your gods and your land. Why should you harden your hearts as the Egyptians and Pharaoh hardened their hearts after he had dealt severely with them? Did they not send the people away and they departed? Obviously, the story of the Exodus is known throughout the region, and it has become very clear to the Philistines that their regional gods are no match for Jehovah, just as Pharaoh discovered that his regional gods were no match for Jehovah. I mean, there's no record of any of them getting converted. They continue to cling to their own gods, but they recognize that Jehovah is clearly out of the league of their gods because their gods can't protect them. So they figure the better part of valor is to get it out of their land and send it with an offering. Verse 7. Now then, take and prepare a new cart and two milk cows on which there has never come a yoke, and yoke the cows to the cart, but take their calves away from them, and take the ark of the Lord and place it on the cart and put in a box at its side the figures of gold which you are returning to him as a guilt offering. Then send it off and let it go its way and watch. If it goes up on the way to its own land, to Beth Shemesh, then it is he who has done us this great harm. But if not, then we shall know that it is not his hand that struck us. It happened to us by coincidence. So get the deal here. They got milk cows, which is to say cows with calves that are nursing. And a cow with a calf that is nursing doesn't want to leave her calf. Nothing else. After a while, she gets very uncomfortable if the calf doesn't milk her. So the idea then of separating the calves from the cows is by way of not having the cows get distracted by the bawling of their calves. So what we want is these milk cows uninfluenced, if you will, by any outside force. So then we're going to point them up the road. And if they head back to Beth Shemesh and just keep right on going, then we know that God has accepted our offering and we know that he's going to let us go. If, however, they turn around or don't get up there or nothing works here, then we're just going to say, well, this whole thing is a coincidence. It wasn't the God of Israel at all. So verse 10, the men did so and took two milk cows and yoked them to the cart and shut up their calves at home. And they put the ark of the Lord on the cart and the box with the golden mice and the images of their tumors. And the cows went straight in the direction of Beth Shemesh along one highway, lowing as they went. And I'm assuming that they're lowing as they go because they are missing their calves, but that's a guess. They turned neither to the right nor to the left. And the lords of the Philistines went after them as far as the border of Beth Shemesh. Now the people of Beth Shemesh were reaping their wheat harvest in the valley, and when they lifted up their eyes and saw the ark, they rejoiced to see it. The cart came into the field of Joshua of Beth Shemesh and stopped there. A great stone was there, and they split up the wood of the cart and offered the cows as a burnt offering to the Lord. And the Levites took down the ark of the Lord and the box that was beside it, in which were the golden figures, and set them upon the great stone. And the men of Beth Shemesh offered burnt offerings and sacrifices on that day to the Lord. And then the five lords of the Philistines saw it. They returned that day to Ekron. So mission accomplished. We got two orphan calves, but we're rid of that thing that has been plaguing us. And of course, we have some Levites there, and the Levites are the ones that move the ark around, as they should. 17. These are the golden tumors that the Philistines returned as a guilt offering to the Lord, one for Ashdod, one for Gaza, one for Ashkelon, one for Gath, and one for Ekron. And the golden mice, according to the number of all the cities of the Philistines belonging to the five lords, both fortified cities and unwalled villages. The great stone beside which they set down the ark of the Lord is a witness to this day in the field of Joshua of Beth Shemesh. Verse 19. And he, God, struck some of the men of Beth Shemesh because they looked upon the ark of the Lord. He struck 70 men of them, and the people mourned because the Lord had struck the people with a great blow. Then the men of Beth Shemesh said, who is able to stand before the Lord, this holy God? And to whom shall he go up away from us? So they sent messengers to the inhabitants of Kirjath Jearim, saying, the Philistines have returned the ark of the Lord. Come down and take it up to you. And the men of Kirjath Jearim came and took up the ark of the Lord and brought it to the house of Aminadab on the hill and they consecrated his son Eleazar to have charge of the Ark of the Lord. From the day that the Ark was lodged at Kirjath-Jearim, a long time passed, some 20 years, and all the house of Israel lamented after the Lord. I am not sure who Amminadab is. I don't know why Amminadab is worthy, but I find it interesting that Israelites died and Philistines just got tumors, or hemorrhoids. And I take that to be because the men of Israel should know better. I don't know how widespread Torah knowledge was among common people, but they had the instructions of God, whereas the Philistines, God was just messing with them. And I find this to be one of the most humorous passages in Scripture. But I guess it's sort of like you remember in the wilderness when God gave the commandment about Sabbath. Remembering the incident of the guy picking up sticks on Sabbath, when God tells his people something, very often he will take the first violator and make an example of him. As far as I know, and this is speaking from silence, I don't know that anybody else ever got stoned for picking up sticks on the Sabbath. It was simply God's way of saying, I mean this, pay attention. And so the idea of the ark killing 70 people is, I think, in the same vein. The ark is serious. It's not something to be carried around like a lucky rabbit's foot. And in the case of the Philistines, they don't know any better. So he just messes with them, plagues them with mice and hemorrhoids, whereas the people of Israel should know better, and the people of Israel are going to be the ones who have the ark thereafter. So he may simply be making a point. The comment was that he thinks that the ark was probably uncovered. And of course, you all know from the Torah that when the ark was moved and was taken out of the Holy of Holies, it was covered with three coverings. Once it was covered, it was able to be carried along with the people of Israel out in the open. And the comment was it probably got uncovered in the process of getting captured and a bunch of other stuff. And I think you may be right. Don't know, but I think you may be right. And I don't know whether they had another set of coverings that they real quick brought down and covered the ark up so they could get it up to Kirith. I just don't know the answer to that. Again, the comment was, he gets the idea that Hophni and Phinehas didn't bother to cover it when they took it into battle. That's entirely possible. I just don't know.